You are a human animal. You are a very special breed. For you are the only animal who can think, who can reason, who can read.
Hi, and welcome to Bookworm. My name is Michael Silverblatt, and today my guest is Mona Simpson, the author most recently of The Lost Father, which has just come out as a vintage paperback, and of Anywhere But Here. Well, I guess I'd begin by talking to you about this family in your books and what made you decide to take on the same family in a second book.
Well, actually, I didn't really decide. I'd actually written the first book, and when I was finished with it, you know, of course, you're reviewed for your first book, and so many reviews for a first book kind of end with a dare. They kind of end up saying, but we'll see what she does next, which, of course, made me want to go out and write the Great American War novel or some such thing to prove that I could. And I actually started to write a very different book. I started to write a kind of... I want to say this without being pretentious. I didn't mean it to be as good as Middle... You know, I didn't aspire. I hoped it would, but I didn't think it would be as good as Middlemarch. But I wanted to write a book about sort of people in their 20s and 30s starting out very idealistically with ideas and aspirations about work and follow them over 5 or 10 years and see what happened to those aspirations when they came up against reality and love and all that. And I started that book, and I worked on it for a while, but it wasn't going that well. I had that sort of uphill struggle that I guess one often has, but it didn't really take off. I don't know, I think people ask, you know, how do you pick your subjects? Well, really it's like falling in love or something. You don't pick them. They sort of pick you and you follow. And then, so I was going along in this book that wasn't going so well. And then the idea for The Lost Father started. And I did really fall into it. And it was much more inevitable and kind of uncurled before me. So I just wrote that. It was very much the more natural thing to do. And after that, at that point, it had been a few years since Anywhere But Here. So I just decided, well, this is what I'm going to do. And it's funny because now I've actually gone back to the novel that I was writing, that I tried to write. And a few years have passed. I've thought about it more. And it seems much easier now. It's probably a matter of thinking about it or maybe, and I don't have that sort of willful, you know, I'm going to prove I can do this feeling about it. So it's coming much easier.
I've read this twice now because read it when it came out in hardcover, and I persist in the feeling that it's a very eerie book. Is it for you too? I'll tell you what I mean, but I'm just curious what your feeling about it is.
I think of it as a very dark book, but I guess eerie? I don't know. What do you mean by
eerie?
Well,
you see, it came to me as I was trying, you know, in your mind, you try and think, well, what is my experience of this like? And I guess if Anywhere But Here was a book about the actual and survival and the inevitable, with the edge being the mother's borderline insanity, this book is about the ideal, the absent, the inessential, the intangible,
mm-hmm.
The projected.
Very much so. Yeah, that's very true.
And so it seems to be composed out of gists. It seems to be more a series of suffusions than exactly plot motions,
mm-hmm.
bits of memory. And
yeah, I wanted to be very much one character's wrestling with the invisible, you
mm-hmm.
know, which is a very different kind of book than the actual.
Yeah, well, it seemed to me that, you know, if the first book was about how a character is shaped by her surroundings, this book is about the shaping of character by fantasy or
yeah.
by imagination.
Or how a character is not shaped by their surroundings.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's true. I think, you know, on the most storyline level, the first book is very much about a mother who was very much there, and a mother and daughter who were partners in a very intense and tangible way. They spent all their time together, and they fought, and they it felt, you know, the great range of emotions that are possible in any intense relationship, everything from love to hate to aggravation to tenderness and sort of the whole panoply. The second book was very much about the character's relation to a father who really wasn't there and what that meant and what that created in her and what she did about it. It's about a young woman who's grown up pretty much without a father, who's gone along and gone to college and is now just starting medical school and has really sort of gotten that far despite this sort of nagging, substantive but internal thing that's there. And at one point she just really decides, she develops a sort of compulsion to find him and hires private detectives and really goes on a search for him.
Yes, and yet what I found, I guess, I'm going to describe a book that may be... See, I would want to read the book that I'm about to describe, which is the book I read, but I'm curious as to whether it's the book you wrote, and you can tell me, because the book, you know, the book you're describing sounds sort of normal. The book I read is full of a strange... I don't even know how to describe it. Projected quality. For instance, at one...
Oh, of course, but there's nothing normal about a book in which the major character is basically not there until the last 40 pages.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's what I mean. That's what I found so interesting. Because, for instance, she says at one point, there are three things my family... you can expect my family never to have. Sunglasses, umbrellas, and I forget what the third thing is. And yet... around 20 pages earlier, having visited her mother, she said she was a regular up-and-down kind of person with sunglasses.
Right, and father ends up having those attributes, too.
And you kind of go, And then you think, too, of the mother who you've at first thought has pretended to have cancer when what she needs is a scraping. And the daughter says, why did you fool me? And the mother says, well, I didn't. You're making this up, brother. And it's scary that a mother calls her daughter brother, to my mind, at any rate. And you think, okay, so the mother is playing tricks. But then later in the book, the detective tells her that he's got a lot of information about the missing father. And in fact, he doesn't. And you become aware that the character is projecting her desires into her telephone conversations, that things that she wants to hear or fears to hear are things that she actually hears. Some of these things come up later as actualities, but at the moment, they're not there. And then I started to add to this. I mentioned to you some months ago that I loved a Cornish game hen that appears in this novel, but I thought... that altogether you have quite a way with poultry. I'll describe. The young woman, Ann Stevenson, is that the... Yes.
Yeah.
Also, by birth, Maya Natasi, Egyptian father. She's taken a more common name and the name of her mother's second husband. She has shrines to her father... and on them, at one point, she starts burning food the way you would to a missing god. And she burns a Cornish game hen and watches it consume itself until it's nothing, just ash. Earlier in the book, she describes bringing a rotisserie chicken back from the store, carrying it in its tinfoiled bag back to her apartment and sniffing its warmth within the bag, which makes her think about sex with another woman. And I thought, my goodness, what peculiar things happen to these people when brought into contact with poultry. But I'm beginning to suggest that the tone of the book is, to my mind, very mysterious and very, you know...
I think you're... I see it as... kind of half that and half not that. I certainly intended the vein you're picking up on, but I also wanted there to be a more a more material vein too. You know, I also wanted it to be about literally a young woman who hasn't had a father, who gives up a great deal and is now living this life very close to the edge. She had a certain little amount of money she inherited from her grandmother, which she should have been using by all reasonable accounts for medical school. And I wanted it to be very much about someone who follows a personal impulse to an incredible and dangerous and probably insane degree. But I did want sort of both levels. I wanted that kind of mysterious, eerie, dark level. But I also wanted the kind of the true story, the story of it, too.
I'm talking to Mona Simpson about her recent novel, The Lost Father, now in paperback from Vintage. Well, I think that the naturalistic level makes the subjective or imaginary level still more eerie. I guess it would be just another subjective psychosis book if it weren't for the fact that the actual world is observed with sort of constant clarity.
I think when I'm working on something, I like to have both things. I think you can't sort of work every day just on the subliminal levels of a book or just on the story. I think you kind of need both reverberating.
Tell me, when you were working on The Lost Father, did you see it as distinct from, as opposed to a continuation of, Anywhere But Here?
I sort of saw it as both. I mean, I actually started it as a different book, you know, without any intention to. I mean, I always write first drafts very intuitively and without much planning. I kind of use a first draft once it's finished as an outline and then tinker with the structure from that. So the first draft, I really just wanted it to be about a character's fight and wrestling to find with this absent and invisible and not there presence. But then when it was finished, I thought there was a sort of, when the first draft was finished, I realized that it really should be the character from Anywhere But Here, because it really was about the parent who wasn't there. But I thought there was something emotionally inaccurate about that if there wasn't any time devoted to the parent who was there. But I didn't want to do that in this book. This was something else. So it seemed to me a sort of companion piece to Anywhere mm-hmm. But Here.
Do you think about these works philosophically?
I don't know what you mean.
Well, I guess, you know,
I think philosophically. I don't know about these works. I'm rereading Ulysses at the moment.
Well, so, you know, as I say, you know, if one were to say that the first book was a book about presence, in which the title Anywhere But Here suggests a desire to escape out of the present.
Right.
And the second book as a meditation on absence, and because absence, a meditation on the holy. The book begins with a description of belief as a quality in this family, and what constitutes belief, and that godhood is based upon a principle of substantiated absence. Well, these are really, in addition to all the other things, these are very philosophical themes, and I wonder, you know, if you develop them in that way.
It's funny. I mean, I read a lot of theology at the time. You know, I was immersed. I started, I guess, with William James' Varieties of Religious Experience, and then I read a lot of cranky and bizarre books of mystics. But I actually didn't think of it at all when I wrote it the first time. And then I tried to go back in revision and work out inconsistencies and think of it in those ways. I think often you read a lot about ideas, and then you try and forget them when you're actually writing fiction. And then they come up in the fiction, and you may pay attention to them in revision, but I would never start out with a sort of schema and try and argue it through a novel, because I think the novel has to always, for me, actually that's not true, many novels do that, and sometimes they're great.
Well, I end up thinking that there are as many ways to write novels as there are novelists.
I think that's true.
And that it always amuses me when, you know, someone like Tom Wolfe, on the one hand, will say,
yeah, that's true, he's written about it even, should be this.
Should be this. And then you talk to Sorrentino and Joel Sorrentino, novels sure. should be art. And I think, well, novels should be whatever the novel turns out as, you know. And readers are grateful because the novel, it's not just that the novel is, what is it, a goose baggy monster or whoever said that.
But War and Peace, no less.
Yes.
Henry James
on War and Peace. But that the novel is sometimes a goose baggy monster, sometimes a hard gem-like flame, sometimes, mm-hmm. you know, there must be
Absolutely.
Every kind of novel.
Absolutely. And by the way, I don't think that War and Peace is a loose baggy monster. I once went through it and looked at the structure, and actually it's quite neatly. It's most of the sections are about the same length. It alternates like a waltz. It's quite orderly, actually. It's long.
Well, you know, I think that for James, it's a loose baggy monster because his concentration was on point of view.
Yes.
So anything that becomes historically epic violates some principle of intensity and concision for him. But what about questions like point of view? Did you say after finishing The Lost Father, never again one mind for 500 pages?
I certainly said it for the next book. never say never, but the next book is third person and has quite a few points of view, and it's really fun. I mean, it's exhilarating to do something different. But no, I mean, that was a challenge for me, but it was a worthwhile one. I think that, again, I think you don't really choose these things, you know, but I think, and first person has such advantages, you know, that kind of close first person, and such potential power, and such shortcuts in it. On the other hand, it's after writing two books, each fairly long, in first person, it's a great freedom to work in third. It took me a while to find the right third. You know, you have to sort of find yourself in a voice, and it took me a while, but once I found it, I'm really, really glad.
You know, I'm not interested in anyone's life story, so this
right.
is not a question that's being used to elicit information, but rather
sure.
General information. I know many people who, when they read Anywhere But Here, especially in this city, started telling me their stories about their father, who was a publicist for the studio, and how Bogart had been at their parents' wedding and felt that Anywhere But Here had caught something of a childhood in Hollywood, even though the characters come here rather than being born here. And many people wanted to have already written their novel when yours came out. And since that book, I can think of some others that are, you know, in its vein. Kate Braverman recently has a novel called Wonders of the West about a mother and a daughter. But I wanted to ask about autobiography because I gather that to one extent or another, this fiction is autobiographical, but surely it's something else as well. What is the relation between actual event and fictionalizing of event for you?
Well, it's funny. I think about it a lot because I think it's very much a question of translation. I think that it's funny. I was thinking about this semester because I teach once a week, and one of my students wrote a story that just didn't work at all. It was about a little girl, maybe 8 or 9 years old, who was at summer camp and put cyanide or some rat poison maybe in the Kool-Aid and poisoned the other girls, and they got very sick and went to the hospital, and her parents obviously were very upset. And I talked to the student because it really didn't have any power or resonance. It felt very phony and made up, and I asked her about it and how she composed it and what had struck her with it. And it turns out it was actually all true. It was completely, she had actually done this. But yet, somehow, these true facts, when transposed to fiction, nothing could have seemed more phony and made up. And I think there are laws to each, well, certainly there are laws to fiction. I don't know about life. Life can be a mess, as Ian Forrester says, with too many ants. But ants, A-U-N-T-S. But I think that for me, it's funny, many people have asked me about the books because they're in first person. And there's certainly the biggest element of autobiography, I think, in the books is I did come to California myself. I moved to Los Angeles from the Midwest when I was 12. And that was a very powerful and seminal event in my life. Now, I came under very different circumstances and with very different parents and all that. But I think that was the main event I've used for my life. I certainly use places that I've lived. You know, I'm not writing about Alaska, New Zealand. I think the most important autobiographical tool for me is that I use a kind of or try to use some inflections and some idiomatic English and a lot of that that I've grown up with, a lot of regional idiomatic English that you can really only mine. You can't create it, or at least I don't think anybody ever has. So that's the main source I use. In terms of the plot, in terms of the characters, no, not so much. I mean, not that I disapprove of writing straight from life. I mean, I think, you know, if you grow up in the circus or if you witness an incredible inferno of some sort, I mean, I don't think Primo Levi should have touched his memoirs, you know, one stroke. But most of us grew up in much messier, less coherent circumstances, which don't necessarily make for fiction.
Well, there's a sub-theme, it struck me, in The Lost Father. I think that gradually this book gets to Egypt. The father is Egyptian. And I think that one of the unexplored territories, if a whole set of flowerings in America began with the Jewish novel, followed by the woman's novel and the gay novel, that one of the last and perhaps most resisted explorations is of the Middle East. And it seemed to me that that heritage makes its way into this novel as if through a huge unconscious preparation for it. Hmm. Did you feel that when you were writing?
Well, I think so. And I think, you know, I've been learning Arabic, which I had been learning when I was writing The Lost Father, so probably that had something to do with it. I think actually there are little bits of Arab American literature coming into the culture at this point. I think it's actually there's been much more recent Arab American migration, so possibly that'll happen.
There's also the interest in mafouz,
right? And, absolutely,
but it's just beginning. You know, I think there's a trio of novels called Cities of Salt.
Oh, yeah, which is wonderful.
Amazing. Munif,
yeah.
Is that?
It's wonderful. It's all about Saudi Arabia and how in two generations, you know, people went from living in tents to huge skyscrapers.
Do you find, can you characterize so far what you found in that literary tradition for you in your reading or your personal exploration?
Well, it's very hard to say because it's a very hard language to translate from. So you're often wading through a bit of bad translation.
Mm-hmm.
The tradition of poetry is beautiful and incredible. The tradition of fiction is very interesting, but it's in a funny way. I think it might seem old-fashioned. At least novels literally coming from the Middle East. I think Arab American literature is something which will be altogether different, and any way in which I fit in this is, and I'm only half Arab, but it certainly is an Arab American, not as someone from the Middle East. I certainly didn't ever live there. And I think novels at the moment from the Middle East may seem to us a bit old fashioned. In structure, in the tradition of storytelling. They're very magisterial generally, and very clannish in a strange way.
It was interesting. Someone once described to me, he was telling me that Proust's memories of things past an effort which took 7 volumes, was encapsulated in 1 line by an Arab poet in a poem that began, "Go away, I want to remember you."
That's wonderful. That's wonderful. I would say there's quite a bit in remembrance of things past, however, which would elude that one, though beautiful line, his whole disquisitions on love and swans. There's quite a bit that is on a different vein.
What's the novel you're working on called now?
It's called A Regular Guy.
And what are you thinking of for its completion?
I think this one is a little faster, I think. And I'm hoping to finish it by Christmas time, but you never know, you know.
Do you, it could just be that for me, reading novels is like going into a bell jar, and I start to experience them vortically or something. They whirl around me like a tornado. And do you feel yourself sphered by the book that you're working on? When I'm reading,
very much,
I'm
very much, and also by the books I'm reading. I mean, I'm always only reading one book at a time, and I feel very much involved in it.
Well, most writers tell me that they never read Ulysses when they're writing.
I don't feel that at all. I feel Ulysses is about as close to 1992 as I can read while writing. But I think the 19th century leaves one virtually untouched. I mean, I think, of course, writers are always worried about being influenced by what they read.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even if you were deeply influenced by Tolstoy or Chekhov or George Eliot. I mean, most of us should be more influenced, I think, by Proust and Kafka and George Eliot.
Mm-hmm.
But I think even if you were, I think we're writing about such a different world and our experience is so different that it would come out completely different. I can't even imagine having any kind of influence from those books. And Joyce is such a singular, eccentric voice that you couldn't possibly do that again.
Well, one hopes
he couldn't do it again.
He refused to
God
do
knows
it again.
I couldn't do it again.
Most of us can't do it once. I mean, it's an astonishing thing, you know.
It's
but
a great
you
thing.
Emerge from Ulysses a different person than the
Absolutely.
Person you went in.
I think so. I think the same of Remembrance of Things Past or War and Peace as well.
Yeah, no, that's the amazing thing about novels, that if they somehow hold their writers in check when they're being written, they change their readers, and that's, you know, a very odd thing, that the thing that the novelist has had to be enslaved to is the thing that becomes a catalyst for the reader. The book becomes a part of one's experience, and the more intense it is, the more the reader comes out virtually transformed by that experience.
I think the writer comes out transformed from writing a book, too.
In what way?
Well, I think in a way the real answer to what is autobiographical in one's books is not anything that happened to you in your life, or not that you based a character on your uncle or anything like that. It's usually that you really are wrestling with your own torments and with your own, on a symbolic level, on a translated level, but I think it replaces certain demons or certain obsessions for you, and you then move on to new ones.
I've been talking to Mona Simpson, the author of The Lost Father, recently published as a paperback from Vintage Books. Thank you, Mona. It's good to
Thank
see you.
Thank you. You too.
My associate producer is Melinda Siegel. My engineer is Scott Fritz. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next week on Bookworm.
To the jungles you can go in books. To the land of vices, go in books.
As you ramble through the pages, books will take you through the ages. Back to days of old when knights were bold and books.
Books, 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 books. Books. Books can be funny too.
Books make you laugh and sing. Books tell you everything. They're your treasure, friends in prose and rhyme.
Now with book of the mouse, pop time.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.